Welcome back to the program. Many consider it the civil rights issue of our time. Same-sex marriage has also become one of the most politically volatile. It divides red and blue America, most profoundly divides generations, and perhaps more than any other single political issue, it is one on which attitudes are constantly changing. While polarized positions on issues like guns, the death penalty, and immigration harden over time, in the case of gay marriage, the public seems to be becoming more accepting. In the next few days, we'll know if the U.S. Supreme Court is going to take up California's Proposition 8, but regardless, it will hear one of many cases on the issue of gay marriage. Because more than anywhere else, the battle is being fought in the courts, as well as the political battlefield. That's our focus today, as we're joined by our guest, Michael Klarman. He is the Kirkland & Ellis Professor at Harvard Law School. He's the author of numerous previous books about the struggle for civil rights. And it is my pleasure to welcome Michael Klarman here to talk about his newest work, From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. Michael Klarman, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
It's great to have you here. One of the most remarkable things, I suppose, about this whole saga of gay marriage that's been going on for almost 20 years now, actively as a discussion, is how attitudes are changing. Unlike so many other politically volatile issues, we are seeing a constant shift in terms of public opinion. Talk about that.
So opinion is changing dramatically. If you go back and look at the earliest polls, which were taken 1990 or just before that, certainly fewer than 25% of Americans supported gay marriage. It might have been closer to 15%. Today, the most recent polls show over 50%. I think there was a Gallup poll recently showing the country supported gay marriage by something like 51 to 41%. So there's been a dramatic shift over time. A lot of it is a result of the coming out phenomenon. The evidence is that as more people come out as gay, more people have friends and neighbors and family members who they know to be gay, and people tend to want positive things for the people that they know and love. So that's had a big effect on attitudes. You see that most dramatically with young people. Young people support gay marriage by margins as high as 70 to 30%. And there's no evidence at all as they get older that support diminishes in any way. So as younger people displace older people, that you're going to have even more support for gay marriage in the years to come.
You've written quite a lot about the civil rights struggle. How is this battle for civil rights on the part of the gay community and the struggle for gay marriage, how has it moved along different legal and political lines than the previous civil rights efforts?
Each civil rights struggle is distinctive in various ways. There are some commonalities, but there are also differences. So, you know, African Americans in the South were functionally denied the right to vote, which makes it very difficult to influence politics, whereas there's never been any meaningful restriction on the ability of gays and lesbians to exercise the franchise. On the other hand, African Americans, you can tell somebody's race for the most part by looking at them, which makes it easier to organize a group because members of the group really don't have any choice but to participate in protests because they can't, in any meaningful sense, exit from the group, whereas gays and lesbians could remain in the closet. And in an era like in the 1950s, 1960s, where there were powerful penalties for being identified as gay, people had real disincentives to come out of the closet. So gays and lesbians were much harder to organize. Both groups have made advances through the courts. I think it's probably fair to say that the courts were ahead of the curve, ahead of the political curve on these issues. Brown versus Board of Education was decided in 1954, which was a full decade before Congress was willing to do anything meaningful on civil rights. And you see the same thing with gay marriage, that a court in Hawaii, which was really the one that put this on the map in 1993, that was at a time that in Hawaii itself, which was one of the most liberal states in the country on gay rights issues, only about 30% of the populace supported gay marriage, and in the country as a whole it would have been even less. So one interesting commonality is that court decisions on both of these issues actually probably sparked public debate because they were so far ahead of the curve of public opinion and what was going on politically.
One of the things we've seen, though, with respect to the gay marriage issue is that every time that there's a court ruling, a significant one, you mentioned the Hawaii case and 10 years later the Goodrich case in Massachusetts, that it engenders a legal and political backlash, whether it's referendums or other court cases and legislation.
Yeah, the backlash is a really dramatic facet of the gay marriage movement. So, you know, just describing it and then maybe trying to say a word about analyzing it. The Hawaii court in 1993 strongly suggested that there was a constitutional right to gay marriage. And within a decade, 35 states and Congress had passed defense of marriage laws. And that was directly responsive to the court decision. Then 10 years later, as you say, the Massachusetts Supreme Court became the first in the country to squarely rule in favor of gay marriage. That was at a time that opinion polls showed Americans still opposed gay marriage by 2-1. That year, or the next year, 2004, there were 13 referenda, all of which rejected gay marriage. Within the next couple of years, there were altogether 25 such referenda suppressing gay marriage under state constitutions. And the issue played a large role in the 2004 elections, really at all different levels of election, all the way up to the presidential election where gay marriage was a big issue. So, yeah, court decisions that get in front of public opinion do generate political backlash. And I think the reason is not so much that it's a court doing something rather than a political branch of government, but simply that the courts were resolving an issue that at that time no political branch of government would have resolved the same way. So if you want to imagine the counterfactual, would a Massachusetts legislative decision embracing gay marriage in 2003 have produced the same sort of political resistance in the rest of the country that a court decision did? I think the answer is yes, but I think it's also the case that there was no legislature in the country in 2003 that was even that close to adopting gay marriage, and the same thing was true in 1993, obviously. So it's the substance of the decision that generates backlash, but it just seems to be the case that courts sometimes get in front of public opinion.
And yet we have the situation here, albeit California and albeit San Francisco in 2004, of the mayor of San Francisco at the time getting way out ahead of everybody else.
Right. So Mayor Newsom would not have done what he did had it not been for the Massachusetts court decision. So this is a good illustration of how a court decision in November 2003 makes an issue salient, and it leads to politicians responding. Mayor Newsom governs a constituency that was strongly in support of gay marriage. He had actually just been narrowly elected just months earlier, and he saw his approval ratings go through the roof all the way up to 85% in the summer of 2004. Ultimately paving the way for a successful race for statewide office years later. That's a function, I think, of the fact that America has a federalist political system where decisions are made at different levels of government and politicians have incentives to cater to their own local constituency. And I don't mean to suggest that this is simply a political calculation. Mayor Newsom was probably also doing what he thought was the right thing, but cannot have been oblivious to the political consequences, which were quite favorable for him in that particular setting. You know, the analog, if you want to look backwards, is, you know, in 1954, when the Supreme Court decided Brown versus Board of Education, Southern politicians who were responding to constituencies that were almost all white because blacks were largely disfranchised, and among whites, 90% in the South thought Brown was wrong, Southern politicians took strong steps to reject Brown, like Governor Faubus in Arkansas calling out the militia to block desegregation of schools in Little Rock. That's an example of politicians responding to local voter sentiment and also responding to a court decision. So I think it's a combination of the court decision putting the issue on the map, forcing politicians to take a position, but then the position they take is responsive to local politics. In San Francisco, that meant supporting the Massachusetts decision, but when television then relayed scenes of gay couples getting married on in San Francisco City Hall and then exchanging kisses on the steps of City Hall. That was something that offended a large part of the country. So you get a phenomenon where politicians trying to implement the decision actually produce backlash in other parts of the country.
In some cases, though, the backlash has produced a need for incremental steps, which is what has led to civil unions in so many cases.
That's right. One, there are lots of different effects of litigation, and one effect of court decisions protecting gay marriage is that it's actually opened up the middle and made civil unions seem a lot less controversial. So you saw that in polls between 2003 and 2005, where voter support for civil unions increased very dramatically. It's hard to remember, but back in 2000, after the Vermont court decision in December of 1999, in 2000, civil unions were the big issue in Vermont, and a lot of legislators who had voted for civil unions actually lost their jobs in the fall 2000 elections. But civil unions went from being a radical innovation to being almost the fallback position of opponents of gay marriage. And today you see that two-thirds of Americans support civil unions. Even conservatives like Rush Limbaugh say they have no problem with civil unions. Part of that is the phenomenon of gay marriage being seen as the radical alternative and civil unions then coming to be accepted as a more moderate change.
And it really is a profound example of how public attitude has changed on this subject. The fact that civil unions have come to be accepted even among those who might have been its political opponents 15, 20 years ago.
That's right. Many people who would have opposed civil unions and gay marriage have now embraced civil unions and are still holding out against gay marriage. In some circles, civil unions still remain very controversial. So, you know, Mitt Romney opposes gay marriage and opposes civil unions. That's the position that many Republican primary voters in places like South Carolina or Republican caucus goers in Iowa, their position would have been to oppose not only gay marriage but civil unions, which they just see as a Trojan horse for gay marriage. That is, I think, a complicating calculation for Republican politicians today, because while the country might still be divided pretty evenly on gay marriage, civil unions are now supported by two-thirds or more, and to take a position opposing them is really to risk making yourself seem very retrograde in this debate.
Mm-hmm. From a legal and legislative perspective, where does the Defense of Marriage Act fit into the equation?
Right. So the Defense of Marriage Act was passed by Congress in 1996. It was kind of forced on Bill Clinton in the midst of a presidential campaign. It was touted as something necessary to enable states to protect themselves from Hawaii deciding to enact gay marriage and then exporting those marriages to other states. The statute has a couple provisions in it. One of them makes it clear that states are not bound to respect lawfully conducted gay marriages in other states. And then the provision that's actually been litigated the most is one saying that the federal government will stick with a definition, not really stick with, the federal government will adopt a definition of marriage, which is the traditional definition of marriage being between a man and a woman, and that's the definition the federal government will use for all its purposes. So that includes calculating things like federal Social Security survivors benefits or deciding whether two people are married for purposes of immigration. That statute has now been subjected to challenge in several different federal courts. It's been struck down by about five different federal district court judges, including in Boston, New York, and I believe in Northern California. It's also been struck down by the First Circuit, which affirmed the lower court decision from Boston. And that's a case that is on the Supreme Court's cert conference today, and they'll decide whether to grant review in that case or not. I think the consensus among legal experts is that it would be easier for the court to strike down the Defense of Marriage Act than it would be to strike down a state ban on gay marriage like California's. And the reason for that is even people who don't necessarily support gay marriage may have a lot of trouble figuring out why the federal government needs to have its own definition of marriage when traditionally marriage was defined by states, not the federal government. So you could imagine a coalition of liberal justices who sympathize with gay marriage, and conservative justices who believe deeply in federalism, combining to strike down the Defense of Marriage Act. There's also a lot of rhetoric when the statute was passed in 1996 that can only be seen from today's perspective as blatantly homophobic, and that would also make it pretty easy to strike down because it's conventional constitutional law doctrine that you can't pass a statute simply for purposes of animus or dislike of any group.
Doesn't it ultimately come down, though, to the opinions of Justice Kennedy?
Most things in constitutional law today come down to the opinion of Justice Kennedy. I think if the question is whether a state can bar gay couples from getting married, I think today that's probably an issue that divides the court between the two standard political blocks, four conservatives, four liberals, and Justice Kennedy would determine the outcome. I think if the issue is the Defense of Marriage Act, I think the decision might actually be more than 5-4. I could imagine it being 6-3, 7-2, striking down the statute. But yeah, I think today Justice Kennedy would be the decisive vote on gay marriage, and it's hard to know for sure how he would come out. I think there are two kind of conflicting tendencies on his part. One is that he usually uses constitutional law to take an ascendant national norm, turn it into a constitutional command, and then use that to suppress what you might call outlier states, states that have not yet kept up with the national norm. So he's done that frequently in cases involving the death penalty or the earlier gay rights case involving state criminal sodomy laws, where he basically said the Constitution's a living document. Most states have eliminated criminalization of same-sex sodomy. I'm going to interpret the Constitution to forbid states from criminalizing that. However, if that's the tendency that prevails, there are only six states and the District of Columbia that currently have same-sex marriage, so you'd be asking Justice Kennedy to take the rule in those six states and turn it into a constitutional norm for the other 44, and that's not something he usually does. The other tendency is, you know, Justice Kennedy wrote the two opinions. He not only voted with the liberals, but he wrote the two opinions dealing with gay rights issues, the one from 1996 involving the Colorado anti-gay amendment, and then the 2003 case involving a constitutional right for same-sex partners to choose their sex partners. And in addition, Justice Kennedy clearly cares about things like his legacy, and on this issue, opinion is changing so dramatically that it's not hard to predict within another decade or two a decision in favor of gay marriage will start to look like Brown versus Board of Education. And then finally, Justice Kennedy is not indifferent to international norms, and you're seeing the same sort of proliferation across the world of gay marriage that you're seeing in the United States. So it's spread to South Africa, much of Northern and Western Europe, Canada, and it's starting to spread elsewhere as well. There are a bunch of additional countries that are pretty close to adopting it. You're starting to see it embraced in cities and occasionally larger jurisdictions in South America. So to the extent Justice Kennedy is influenced in his constitutional interpretations by the trend of international norms, that's another argument in favor of constitutionalizing same-sex marriage.
To what extent does it matter which case the court ultimately takes up? Because there are a number of them that have worked their way up to the court, including Prop 8 here in California, which was decided on very, very narrow grounds.
Right. It's always hard to tell whether the Supreme Court will be influenced by the narrow or broad grounds of the underlying decision it's reviewing. The California decision, which is a Ninth Circuit federal court decision, is, as you say, decided on such narrow grounds that it arguably applies to California and really is not applicable to any other state. The Supreme Court, of course, is not bound to decide a case on the same grounds as a lower court, although you might say there's a tendency on the Supreme Court, and it's probably a conventional maxim. The Supreme Court's supposed to decide constitutional issues on narrower grounds rather than broader ones when those narrow grounds suffice. But one can certainly find cases in American constitutional history where the court has eschewed the narrow ground and gone with the broad one. So I think the answer is, you know, nobody knows for sure. Probably the fact that the Ninth Circuit decision was somewhat narrower would make the court less likely to review it. It may be that, as I said earlier, that because gay marriage is a harder case than the Defense of Marriage Act, the court might be prepared to let this sit for another year or two. It's very hard to know what the justices will do, and it only takes 4 votes to grant review, whereas it takes 5 votes to win. So you could imagine four justices, you know, even the 4 conservative justices, being troubled by the Ninth Circuit decision granting review, and they don't necessarily know which way Justice Kennedy is going to vote when the case is resolved.
In all of these cases, going back to 1993 and then 2003 and everything subsequent to that, has there been any new legal ground broken in all of this, or has been pretty much decided along what we might consider conventional legal lines?
Well, the interesting thing about constitutional doctrine is how malleable it is. So, you know, 40 years ago, there were gay marriage cases being brought in a couple of states, Minnesota, Washington, Kentucky, I think, had cases involving gay marriage litigated about 40 years ago. And the courts just basically laughed the argument out of court because in 1971, 1972, almost no Americans supported gay marriage. That's still at a time that the American Psychiatric Association deemed homosexuality a mental disease. Almost every state in the country still criminalized consensual adult sex between same-sex partners. At that point in time, the argument just struck the judges as ridiculous, and according to conventional constitutional doctrine, they just said the government has a rational basis for limiting marriage as it is always done to a man and a woman, and that's the end of the case. Some of them even invoke the Bible, saying that, you know, the Bible doesn't countenance this. 40 years later, lower court judges are as likely to buy the argument in favor of gay marriage as not. Indeed, the trend in recent years, you know, the Iowa court decision, the California decision, the Connecticut decision have all ruled in favor. Now the argument they buy is marriage is a fundamental right and you don't get to exclude people from marriage. You know, that marriage is fundamental and it's not fair to deny it to certain groups. Now they're much more inclined to see classifications based on homosexuality as being suspect. They're more likely to see a traditional history of discrimination against gays and lesbians. They're more willing to identify those groups as groups that are entitled to special judicial protection. So, you know, in a sense, the doctrine's entirely new, but it's also based on elaborations of existing notions that have always been around. So basically, gay marriage is a claim about liberty and it's a claim about equality. Those are not precisely the same claims that were traditionally made, but there are elaborations on those claims in the same way that a woman's right to an abortion was an elaboration, and in the same way that the right of African Americans not to be segregated in school was an elaboration on what the people who wrote the 14th Amendment meant, because most of the people who wrote the 14th Amendment had no problem with racial segregation in schools. Brown versus Board of Education was an evolution in that concept of equality as applied to changing circumstances, and that's the same thing the courts are doing now.
Is there another way that this whole debate could have been argued in the courts that might have changed the legal landscape?
You know, I don't really think so. I don't think that the precise arguments that lawyers make are going to be knockdown arguments that are utterly convincing to judges. At the end of the day, legal argument on these sorts of open-ended, broad constitutional issues, legal argument is really just substituting for political debate. So people who believe that gay marriage is really important and ought to be protected as a policy are able to find within constitutional notions of liberty and equality reasonable, persuasive arguments to support gay marriage as a constitutional right. People who think that gay marriage is a bad idea, who think it's bad for children, who think it contravenes the Bible, whatever they think makes gay marriage something they oppose as a policy matter, they're also able to find in the conventional material of constitutional law arguments to support their position. In another 20 years, trying to come up with legal arguments against gay marriage will be like trying to come up with legal arguments to defend the constitutionality of school segregation. But in 1954, it's not like white Southerners weren't able to come up with what were at the time and historically seen as respectable arguments as to why the Constitution allowed states to segregate, arguments based on federalism, arguments based on deference to legislatures, arguments based on precedent, arguments based on traditional understanding of the 14th Amendment. So I don't think that if we're looking for a knockdown legal argument, that's probably the right way to explain what judges are doing. I think rather they are reflecting the changing times and their parts of the culture and their parts of the same time period that's producing this dramatic shift in public opinion.
Unlike other civil rights issues, will this continue to be a states' rights issue? Will individual states approach this differently?
Well, that, you know, it's a really interesting question how this will end up evolving. So right now, it is evolving in the states. There are 4 state referenda and 3 states will adopt gay marriage by popular vote, and that will dramatically change the narrative that we hear, which is that every time people vote, they vote against it. Then next year, there will be other states that are right now on the verge of gay marriage and probably will adopt it. So you have civil unions in a bunch of states, places like Hawaii, Rhode Island, Delaware. Those states are very close to enacting gay marriage. If California were to vote on gay marriage today, it is, you know, as close to certain as you can be that the Proposition 8 vote would be reversed because of changes in public opinion, right? It only lost by 5 percentage points 4 years ago, and opinion is changing at the rate of 1 or 2% a year. So if California were to have a referendum, California would vote in favor. Obviously, in other states, there will be much greater resistance. So Mississippi had a referendum in 2004, and Mississippi voted by 86% to 14% against. Mississippi is not going to vote in favor anytime very soon. North Carolina had a referendum in May, and North Carolina rejected gay marriage by 20 points. That sounds like a lot, but when you compare North Carolina to South Carolina, South Carolina had a referendum 6 years earlier and rejected it by more than 50 points. So even in the South, you're seeing a dramatic increase in support for gay marriage. There's a pretty good statistical model that a political scientist has come up with that shows the rate at which this is changing in each state, and his projection is every state within a decade, including Mississippi, will have a majority in favor of gay marriage. You could imagine that states will simply go on adopting it at the rate of a couple a year. Maybe at some point Congress would come along and adopt the law for the country. More likely what will happen is at some point the Supreme Court will decide that this is a federally protected constitutional right and simply mop up the existing outlier states. That's often how constitutional law works in the United States, that you get a bunch of change going on in the states, and then at some point the position seems so clear that it strikes people as a constitutional right, and the Supreme Court declares it to be so, and then you wipe out the remaining states that have been resisting the change.
Michael Klarman, the book is From the Closet to the Altar, Courts, Backlash, and the Struggle for Same-Sex Marriage. Michael, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you.